Hey everyone, this is Steve Mathis. Thanks for listening to the RacerX podcast show. I just wanted to give a shout out to my new friends at BTOSports.com. BTOSports.com has teamed up with yours truly to provide you podcast listeners with a cool free deal. What you want to do is go to BTOSports.com, check out all the sweet stuff from Fly Racing, O'Neill, Stella, FMF, Liat, Vortex, you name it, they carry it. Here's the cool thing, though. When you order more than $100, and really, what's $100 these days? James Stewart has that much in his Lambo ashtray. Anyways, order more than $100, type in the offer code Mathis in the coupon section when you're checking out, and you'll get a special deal. It's so special, they haven't even told me yet. Mathis is M-A-T-T-H-E-S, by the way. So, to recap, go to BTOSports.com, spend $100, type in Mathis in the coupon section, and get some kind of super sweet, hella amazing deal. Remember to check out their closeouts, and BTOSports.com is a proud sponsor of the BBMX team. All right, on to this week's show.
This is a warning. Your brain may explode from listening to this show. We will not be held responsible if it does. You've been warned. And now, welcome to the RacerX Podcast Show with Steve Mathis.
Welcome to the Racer X podcast show. As usual, I'm your host, Steve Mathis, and I want to thank everybody for listening. This week's guest, the name may not knock your wig back, but I'm telling you guys, this is going to be a real interesting guest and one guy I've wanted to get on for a while. And after we had a talk the other day, it made me even more want to get him on the show. This is real interesting stuff for the tech heads out there that are curious about how bikes are tested and built and magazine end of things and even goggles. This guy knows it all. He knows about hole shotting, Washougal. You know it. And my guest is X-Brand Goggles, Rich Taylor. RT, what's going on?
Oh, you know, just hanging out.
How'd you like
to talk to you, man?
How'd you like that intro?
That was unbelievable. Jeez, I got the chills right now.
I know. I guess in the interest of disclosure, and I wrote about this in my column. I do work for you, X Brown. I do some work for you. So this is just for people out there who want to know. So
be careful with the questions.
Yeah,
you're fired.
Exactly. I am your goggle guy at the races, so I'm looking forward to the expansion of X Brand. Last year we had Nathan Ramsey, and this year it looks like it's going to be bigger and better. And hopefully none of the guys I give goggles to, I've talked any shit to, and they're not going to throw them back at me. But anyways, yeah. So you're the owner of X Brand Goggles. Now for years, your dad Hook ran Smith, right? He was the president of Smith Goggles.
Yeah, for almost nearly 20 years, he was the vice president, the president of the motorsports division, and He's been there forever. You know, came from the ski industry where he was a rep for Smith for many, many years before he went to the motorsports side of the business.
So, like when you were a kid, he was always doing Smith. I mean, whenever.
Like, yeah, you know, it's kind of funny. He's actually worked for Scott, and he's worked for a few other goggle companies that you'd never even know the name of from Europe in the ski industry side of it.
Yeah,
You know, I grew up in Sun Valley, Idaho, ski racing and skiing my whole life. So that's kind of how I grew up, and that's what he did. So, it fit the goggle industry.
Yeah, really. And so you yourself, I mean, you raced pro forever. When did you start racing pro? When was your first year?
My first race as a pro was in 1987 on the Nationals.
Okay.
I actually turned pro before that. I turned pro in 86, but
yeah,
I went on to the Nationals in 87, and kind of 88 was my first full year on the Nationals.
And then you did it through like 96 probably, 97?
Yeah, you're good, man.
Yeah.
97 was kind of my last full year, and then I dabbled in it after that. A few years after that, I kind of did selected races, yeah.
I remember one race, you had been out of the game for a while, but I think Corey Hutter did your suspension for a dirt rider test, and you qualified for the main, I think. Maybe.
Yeah. Corey was, he was a good dude. He was out of Chicago. He called me up. He's like, hey, can you hook me up with some magazine stories? Mm-hmm. And so he had an RM250. I just started working for Suzuki at the time, and I flew back and did a couple races and actually had a couple pretty good finishes.
Yeah, like I'm
some cool magazine stories.
I remember thinking, oh, fuck, Taylor still got it. Like, I don't know where he was, where he came from, but he still got it.
That was kind of funny.
I think I was working for Birdwell, maybe, or you know, so you were one of the guys that was whooping my guy. So, so safe to say you've worn a fair set of goggles in your life. You've used a lot of goggles.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I started ski racing when I was 3 years old.
Oh, really?
And I've never, you know, I've worn goggles basically since I was 3 years old, either skiing every day or riding a motorcycle. So
yeah,
I've tried out my fair share of goggles. That's for sure.
So what? So just at one point a few years back, you said, "Hey, you know what? I'm going to make a goggle company." I mean, just from everything that you know, right? It almost was almost too easy. Maybe was that?
Well, when I quit racing, I went to work for Suzuki, being the full-time test rider.
Uh-huh.
And as the years went on, I was like, holy crap, what am I going to do, man? You know, testing's not going to last forever. I think I got hurt one day or something, and I'm like, man, I got two boys, and I'm married with a wife, and I'm like, man, I got to figure something out. And just so happens, Willie Musgrave from MTA called me, and he's like, hey, did you ever think about doing your own goggle? And I'm like, no, not really, you know? I mean, I kind of know what to do, but I never really crossed my mind. I was riding a motorcycle for a living, having fun. And he's like, well, Utopia just dropped us as a distributor. They tried to go dealer direct, and if you do a goggle, we'll commit to a certain number right off the bat.
Yeah.
And I immediately just kind of my eyebrows raised, and I'm like, man, I better get on the phone. And
right.
It was as easy as making a couple phone calls and hooking up with a vendor and starting to do some sampling and getting some product going that I agreed with and that I liked, and the rest is kind of, well, not history yet, but it's going good. So.
Yeah, and so what do you look for in a goggle? Like, I mean, without getting, you know, as I said, you've got so much experience in the goggle industry between yourself and your dad and at the racing pro at the highest level. So what kind of stuff do you look for in a goggle? When you were building it, when you were rejecting prototypes, what kind of stuff was that?
Well, the main thing is everybody's face is different. So mm-hmm. there's no one goggle that's going to fit everybody. A goggle that fits me absolutely perfect might completely be totally wrong on you. So mm-hmm. when we were doing it, I had several guys, Chris Wheeler, who was testing with me, and a whole bunch of my buddies that raced. I used them, man, mm-hmm. and I'd get samples, and we'd immediately go out, and I kind of ended up picking one that everybody kind of liked, you know,
right.
and we ended up getting, you know, I don't want to say lucky because we did so much testing, but the goggle frame we have right now is pretty darn good, man. It mm-hmm. fits a lot of different faces. It fits in nearly every single helmet out there, which, you know, that's a pretty big statement when you look at how many different models Smith has and Scott has and Spy and everybody else. I mean, they've got tons of different goggle models because their goggles don't necessarily fit that many face shapes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Ours, you know, I mean, of course, I own the company, so I'm going to say it's awesome, but it fits a lot of face shapes and it fits in a lot of helmets.
Yeah, that's a big thing, too, because years ago, you know, you had Shoei, Arai, Bell, and that's about it, maybe JT or whatever. But now there's literally, you know, 50, 70 kind, 75 different kinds of helmets. You know, you just never know,
joke.
You know, like
yeah.
it's hard to do. And the reviews for X-Brand, from what I gather, have been great. I also know that something really important for pro riders that maybe amateurs don't realize, but for pro guys is foam. And what do you look for in that? What kind of stuff did you reject or did you like? Because you can pick up a pair of $24 goggles and you can tell a difference.
Oh, absolutely.
You know,
there's kind of a general face foam. It's called an EO15.
It
was what everybody had and everybody used for, you know, a ton of years. And now they, you know, all the companies have kind of stepped up to multi-layer face foams and with a chamois on the front for comfort. So when we designed ours, you know, we looked for the very best face foam out there. And me and all my guys, we tested probably 50 different face foams before mm-hmm. we actually came up with the one that we have. And I mean, my manufacturer was all bummed out at me because I kept, you know, asking for thinner and thicker and more stages of different types of foam. And the one we ended up coming up with is a little bit thicker than what you normally see, but it's actually a four-layer face foam, and it has a little piece of neoprene in the middle of it that actually directs the sweat off of the sides of your face, so you don't get as much splashing onto the lens. And, mm-hmm. you know, I raced for so many years, and the biggest pet peeve in a goggle usually, you know, for a national motocross or a supercross is landing off a jump, and you just get a big old splatter of sweat onto your lens. So,
yeah.
We really concentrated on making something that's we think's the best out there for sure. You know, everybody's going to sweat a goggle out at one point or another. You know,
when I was going to say, it's all
humid and everything, but ours is pretty darn good, man. It turned out really well.
Again, I've heard good things about it from the guys that I worked with. I don't want to make this sound like too pro X brand or whatever, but yeah, it's a goggle that works. What's weird about the like you said, no goggle is going to stop sweat, and many national pros have, you know, the ultimate in goggle technology. They're still putting the tampon on it to get the sweat. What is it? Is it just, are these guys just putting that much more effort into it than an average guy? Like, it's ridiculous, some of these dudes that sweat. I mean, it's just crazy.
Well, I mean, you look at the level of, you know, endurance you have to race motocross, and when you're talking, you're in a big old helmet. You know, you have goggles, you have no wind flow really, except, you know, a little tiny vent holes in your helmet. And, you know, you're sweating your butt off. You're, like I said, you're at Southwick and it's, you know, 99% humidity and 100 degrees out. And, you know, there's not many things much gnarlier than that. You know,
I guess that's true.
Bottom line,
yeah.
You're going to sweat your butt off.
I mean, Reedy's goggles looks like his foam, it looks like a Sealy mattress. Do you know what I mean? Like, just because he sweats so much, it's nothing against his brand of goggle.
Yeah,
they just have so much foam on his goggle. It's ridiculous.
It is what it is.
Yeah.
You do what you can. You only have so much room to work with up there. If the foam gets too wide or too thick, it totally messes up your vision. You know, if your goggle lens is too far away from your eyes, then you see every little speck of dirt that hits the goggle lens. You really notice it. You know, then if the face foam is too thin, then you have nothing. You know, you have no real sweat absorption. So it's definitely a fine line you got to choose. You know, so you still have good vision, you have good airflow, and you still have good absorption.
Did you talk to your dad before you started the company a little bit? Did you pick his brain? At this point, did you know everything that there was to know about goggles?
Well, of course, I thought I knew everything, but I mean, my dad is, I mean, anybody out there listening that knows Hook, you know, he's gnarly. He knows what he's talking about. You know, and he's an unbelievable salesman, you know, so that's really what I rely on him for. He, you know, the guy's invaluable when it comes to selling anything. You know, he knows everything there is to know, man. He could sell anything.
He could sell ice to an Eskimo, huh?
I was going to throw that out there.
Yeah.
I thought it'd be a little corny, but I'll let you do it.
dude, don't worry. I'll do the corniness. Now, is it true? Now, I don't even know if you know this, but now talking about general goggle stuff, is it true that Smith had a patent on the Rolos for all those years, and that's why nobody made them?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it was great. It was, you know, when my dad was there, and they had a patent for, man, it was probably 20 years. I wish I could tell you the exact number, but I don't know.
It was
and
crazy.
It was funny when the patent, you know, it was about 5 or 6 years till the patent was over, we actually went to Scott and sold Scott our roll-offs. We actually built them for Scott.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because we figured, you know what, as soon as our patent's over, they're going to make them anyways, so we might as well make some money off it while we can.
Right.
And, you know, there was one guy in Europe called Rip and Roll who started making them, and we ended up stopping him, and it was pretty funny because the day the patent ended, Rip and Roll was up and going with production on theirs right away.
They were watching.
Yep, so, yep. And now there's, you know, there's probably a half a dozen vendors out there now making roll-off systems that were a perfect copy of kind of one of our original roll-offs.
Yeah.
At Smith. Yeah, it's pretty funny.
It's a gnarly that something so simple works so good and hasn't been replaced. You know, Scott tried that EFS system that my dad paid like $800 for, and the thing was junk.
And every time you rode by a shadow,
yeah,
it went off.
Yeah, yeah, or if it's in your gear bag, the button would just push, you know. And,
yeah,
like, it's just crazy how nobody came up with anything better. Do you know what I mean?
It
was just roll-offs. That was it.
Such a simple idea, and really the technology hasn't changed since the very first one he made. You know, mm-hmm, the cans are a little different, and there's slight differences, but, you know, the width of the film and all that is just kind of, it stayed the same. You know, you get a little bit wider film, and then it'll stick on the lens if it's, you know, it just, what the original one that Bob Smith designed and invented is just, it's awesome.
Yeah, and the turbo fan still around, I think, or it was
absolutely
a little while ago. Yeah,
yep,
for skiing.
Yep. Yeah, they still use it a lot for skiing. It was, you know, a lot of enduro guys love it for sure. It's a great technology as well.
Now, myself having Parts Unlimited background for a couple of years, I know just how gnarly and competitive the goggle market is. How do you try to find space with Scotts and Smiths and Oakleys? I mean, how do you? It's tough, huh?
Oh my God!
I mean, those guys are just producing.
That's the million-dollar question
right
there. You know. There's Parts Unlimited, Tucker Rocky, Western Power Sports, MTA. You know, there's a few big distributors in the U.S. And you know, you just hopefully you can kind of get into one, but you also really need to try to go dealer direct to make it work. Is what I'm learning, because, you know, if you get into a book like Parts Unlimited, they've already got, you know, Thor goggle, Scott goggle, Smith goggle, and then you're just one more goggle in there. You hope the rep goes into the shop and tries to sell, you know? That's kind of the problem. So it's not easy.
No, definitely not. Now, I guess what I was going to say was the X brand does offer a lens and a bag, a goggle bag, which other companies don't. So for basically the same price. So that's
right.
One thing.
What, you know, what we did is when I started the company, I'm like, all right, I can make a bitchin' goggle, that's fine, but how are you going to sell it? There's, you know, how are you just going to go compete with goggle, you know, with an Oakley or a Smith or a Scott that's been around forever, that's a great goggle? How do you just step in the ring and try to fight with them?
Right.
So what I did is I kind of went in with lower prices and added value. You know, we have a really, really nice, you know, sweat foam. Our polyurethane that we use in the goggle frame is a little bit softer than what everyone else uses, so it kind of forms to your face a little bit better. And we offered a mirrored lens and a clear lens in the box.
Yeah.
And our price is quite a bit less than our competitors. Just normal goggles, you know, their normal goggle is actually more expensive than ours with all these, you know, extras.
Yeah,
basically. So that was kind of my
that's the angle,
guy.
Huh?
You know, I ought to be able to sell a million of them. that didn't happen.
Yeah, exactly. Well, check them out at xbrand.com, thexbrand.com, and let's switch gears to your racing career a little bit, man. If you were just born like 15 years too early, because had you had your career nowadays, you'd be in a truck with making 100K and, you know, and supermodels and all that. But anyways, I mean, you had a solid career for a long time, but those were the days where there was four teams and that was it. You know, I mean, what was your lowest number?
30
yeah,
was my lowest number.
And you finished top 10 in the 500s a couple times, I think.
Yep. Absolutely. And you know, I was always like a first or second privateer throughout kind of my later career, for sure. I had some good finishes, for sure, yeah.
Yeah. Does it, I guess, I mean, you're over it, you're not bitter at all, but do you ever think about that? Do you ever, like...
You know, once in a while you'll see a kid who's on, you know, like a, you know, support team or privateer team, and I'll get wind of kind of what kind of money he's making just to be there, and mm-hmm. he won't be making main events, and he'll be kind of rock starring it a little bit, and I'll kind of roll my eyes and just be like, "Damn, dude, you have no idea." But you know, on the other hand, I'm stoked also because I think all these kids need to be making that kind of money. The job they're doing is gnarly. You know, they need to be making that money. So I don't know. It's kind of it goes both ways. You know.
Well, yeah, you're not one of those guys that ran uphill to school both ways. You know, like MXA guys or whatever. You know. What was your best year financially? Like, how did you do as one of the top privateers? Did you ever like come away with money at the end of the year?
In like 96, 93. God, I'm dating myself, aren't I, man? Yeah, 96. I actually had a really good year in 96. I was making, you know, quite a few mains, and I was kind of top 10 in the 250 Nationals the whole year. I had some really good finishes, and I had a pretty good deal with Honda that they were paying me some good contingency, and that was one year that that was pretty good. All through the early 90s, I did pretty well. I'd go to Canada and to Europe and stuff, and I was able to make pretty good money.
Scratch and claw your way. I believe you. Did you not win Montreal one year or Toronto?
I actually led it to like the last lap and fell down and.
That was
I think Dubac ended up winning it.
Yeah.
Dubac or Rollerball was there, too, that year. He was doing good.
Get me started on Rollerball, as you know. you're just basically scratching and clawing out a living, but you're doing it, you know? And, it had to have been tough. And then, you know, the sort of your job at the time was testing for Honda, right? I mean, that was what your kind of full-time job was?
Yeah.
For many of those years?
I got myself into a pretty good position at Honda where, I was doing all their R&D testing, all their durability testing, and plus I had kind of a support ride with them, so I got pretty much all the bikes I needed. I got good parts, and I got an expense account to go racing. So, and then they would actually fly me back during the week, and I'd test all week and then fly back to the races. So, it was there was a few years there that it worked out really well.
I didn't know that. Never mind. I take all that crap back about a struggling privateer.
Well, that was only a couple years out of, you know, 10 or 11 that I was out.
Yeah. A lot of people may remember you from your hole shot at Washougal National, although you don't remember much about it. But you know
what's so funny about that is I still, you know, I'll be traveling with a rep or something, and I'll walk into a shop, and they'll be like, "Oh, yeah, I remember you. You're the guy who led Washougal and knocked himself out."
Yeah.
I get that. I can't even tell you how much I get that. I'm like, I also finished seventh in the National Series.
Yeah.
I don't remember that.
But. No. And, you were on the Boswell carbureted CR250, I believe.
Yeah, that thing was an absolute rocket. It was funny because at Red Bud, we got it. And this guy, Boswell, was, if you don't know any history on it, this guy was a snowmobile guy, and he built just these rocket ship snowmobile motors.
Mm-hmm.
And my mechanic at the time was a Canadian. Sorry about that. But he was a Canadian guy that knew that, you know, in snowmobiles in Canada and all that. And he's like, "Look, we got to try this carburetor on your bike." And we get to Red Bud, and I'm like, "Are you kidding me?" I'm like, "Look at this thing."
Because, it was
hobby looking.
It had Venturi ports in it everywhere, and it was like kind of hose different. It had different hoses on it and stuff.
And it worked completely opposite of a normal carburetor.
Yeah.
So if it was rich, instead of going leaner, you would go even richer. It was like opposite.
Yeah,
so
you'd go in to lean it out.
Exactly. And, anyways, we get to Red Bud, and he puts it on, and I go ride practice. I'm like, "Oh, man, this thing's it's a rocket."
Yeah.
I'm like, "This is insane." And sure enough, first moto, I almost hole shot. Emmett got me, like, coming out of that, you know, it goes left and then that hard right, and he just barely got me in the right. And I'm like, the rest of that year, I knew every time I went to the line that I was going to be top three. For sure. It was the raddest feeling you could ever have. I'm sure, you know, if there's any top pros out there listening, they can understand it. But at the time, I couldn't. But after that race, every time I went to the line, I'd look over and McGrath would be next to me or you know, Emig or Kyle Lewis, who was getting good starts, Larry Ward, all those guys, and I'd just be laughing. I'd be like, I'm for sure going to beat you to the first turn.
I know. I don't know who I was working for. I think it was Birdwell. We had to have one. That was the buzzword in the pits. Like, Taylor's got this Boswell carb, and it is just phenomenal. And we couldn't get one for free, so that was the end of that. Like, the dude wanted, like, $600 or whatever it was, you know? And so that was the end of that. But we all knew what your secret was, RT. We just, you know?
But there was more to it. The funny thing was, even DeCoster, he came up to me and was asking me all about it, and he got one for his – LaRocco was riding for Suzuki at the time. And he got one for LaRocco's bike. LaRocco used it a couple weeks, and they're like, yeah, it's pretty good. But, you know, they didn't really know. But what I had, which I didn't, you know, feel that I needed to tell any of those guys, but I had Boysen built me a special reed cage and intake.
Oh,
for it.
Okay.
That was gnarly. I mean, it was like a one-off big old chunk of...
It was matched to the intake, I guess, and all that.
And it was all matched, and it had this Venturi... like holes in it that would like blow, I don't know, it did something to the gas, and the bike was just insane. Yeah. Like I said, every time I went to the line, I'm like, dude, I don't care, you know, McGrath's Works bike's not even going to come close.
Yeah, yeah.
It was hilarious. But of course, I didn't tell DeCoster about any of that.
And it really was that simple, like bolting the carburetor on, like for reals, like your bike was exactly the same, and then you bolt this carburetor on.
And you know, I ran a Pro Circuit pipe, and silencer, but my head and cylinder were completely bone stock, just because I liked, you know, I did all the testing for Honda at the time, and I was used to it and I liked it, but it was a bone stock motor except for a pipe and silencer and that carburetor.
Damn. Do you have a favorite race of yours of all time? You know, do you have Supercross or Nationals or whatever?
Well, the one that stands out was Steel City in, I think 96, maybe. Mm-hmm. I rode really good. I was actually in third on the last lap of the second moto, and I made a mistake, and I got passed by Doug Henry and somebody else, Kyle Lewis or somebody. But, I just remember riding really good, and there was a race at Hangtown one time when I had back when Bradshaw was racing, he was on Team Honda or Team Yamaha, and I just remember just being right there the whole time. Just,
like you're like that's Damon Bradshaw.
yeah. I mean, I won races in Canada and in Europe and stuff like that, but it just seemed like when you're racing the dudes and you do good, that's just kind of what sticks out in my mind. You know, the top guys, if they're listening right now, they're like, you know, what, he was in fifth place or sixth place.
Yeah.
But that's pretty gnarly when you really think about it, you know. And you know, I was pretty proud of it.
Yeah, no, for sure. Yeah, you were legit, RT, I think, anyways, you know. I don't know. But how did you get started with Honda testing, like, how old were you? How long did you do it for? Did they come to you? How did that all come together?
You know, that's a funny story, because I actually, when I first came to California to start racing, I was like 18 years old, and I got hooked up with Dirt Rider magazine, and Willie Simons, I don't know if you remember him, but he was a local Southern Cal pro
test
super
rider.
Fast.
Yeah.
He was doing durability testing for Honda, and they needed another guy. This was in 1986.
Oh, shit. And, it was that far back, huh? I didn't know that.
80, it might have been 87.
Yeah.
And I went out there with him, and that was like the first day of durability testing that I ever did.
Mm-hmm.
And then they just called me to do durability for like 2 years. And then after that, DeCoster asked me to do some like race team testing.
Yeah.
I started doing that. And
like
then
89 or 90?
R&D testing for Honda, and that was it.
So that's kind of like the, from what I know from working at Yamaha, durability is the lowest of the low. It's like $100 a day, ride, whatever, 3 30-minute motos or whatever it is. Then the race team testing is good, is a step up, and then the R&D testing is another step up. Is that kind of how it is? I mean,
yeah, pretty much. I mean, the race team testing, you know, and there's not a lot of it.
Right.
It's more kind of weeding out the good from the bad. So, you know, Japan will send over a whole bunch of really trick parts, of which, you know, maybe half of them will be any good, and the other ones will just suck.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just kind of weeding it out so that when they do give it to the big guys, they don't have to they don't have to do so much testing.
Yeah. Now, how much did you make for durability, and what did you have to do for that in a day?
It was exactly what you said. For Honda, it was 3 30-minute motos, and we were making, like, I think we were making 150 or 200 bucks a day.
Yeah. And you would just take bone stock bikes? And just
bone stock, you know, and I think in 87 or in 86 we were doing it when we had 87, you know, pre-production bikes. Mm-hmm. And by the end of the first day, your hands would be no skin left on them. None.
Yeah.
They would just blister you to death.
They don't want to hear that, though, when you're complaining.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
No, you just tape them up and go. Yeah, and they take lap times, too, so it was always kind of a big competition with everybody. It was fun. Actually, it was a good time. It was brutal, but it was super fun.
Well, yeah, if you're 18, 19, you're like, sweet. Like,
yeah.
Right? I mean,
making money.
Yeah. Riding a dirt bike, making money, racing a dirt bike. It allowed you to get more of those painted helmets that you had with the potato on the top.
Famous potato, yeah.
Right? Totally. I remember that. So then the race team stuff, when did you start doing that? What years was that? Was McGrath there then and Lampson and those guys?
Yeah, yep. It was basically then Bale was there.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, further back.
Yeah, Bale, Kudrowski, Lampson. It was just all through the early 90s, basically, that I was really doing the race team stuff.
Did they have you there on the same day that those guys were there? Or was it kind of like, hey, we're going out with Rich this week, and then next week the test guys are going to test what Rich sort of narrowed down?
Yeah, that's usually how it went. Occasionally, I'd be out there with them. Usually I would do it, and then they'd give it to them. A lot of times, you know, they'd come out and practice while I was doing it.
Yeah. Was this at Honda Land, the famed Honda Land?
Well, we'd do it out in Simi Valley. There used to be a place called Honda Land.
Yeah.
It was gnarly. They had two outdoor tracks of which they would hook them together, and then they had just the most brutal supercross track ever.
Wow. I've just seen pictures. I've never.
Just, I think a guy named John Savitsky, I think, built it. Just everything was just peaked and just gnarly.
And supercross back then, I mean, your bikes weren't tuned that well for supercross. You guys were all learning, you know?
Yeah, plus we had no idea what we were doing.
Yeah,
exactly. Hit it.
Lachine would tell me he'd go out for Palm Avenue to go practice for the local supercrosses, you know? Like,
exactly.
He'd just be like, I don't know, I'm going to Palm Avenue.
It used to be pretty cool, though, when Bale would show up, though, because, you know, he was just a step ahead of everybody. And the way that guy rode and the things, we'd be out there doing durability, and he would show up just to practice. And he would just go jump. He would, like, go hit a jump, like some crazy, weird, like, quarter pipe, you know, almost like a skateboard ramp type jump. And he'd hit it for, like, 20 minutes. He'd just sit there and hit it and hit it and just get completely whipped upside down.
Uh-huh.
I mean, just you'd just sit there with your jaw open just going, oh, my God, you know. The guy was completely incredible. And then he would do, like, he'd just do the whoops. He'd just go blitz the whoops, turn around, blitz them back. And that was before blitzing was.
Yeah, he invented that. He really started that, didn't he?
He was just. And he did it, you know, he rode, you know, you see guys that muscle the bike and really, like.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't. He was just all finesse and just amazing. And then he would load his bike up and leave. Like, he'd never do a full lap.
Yeah, yeah.
Wouldn't sweat. And I'd just be like, dude. And then he'd go to the race on the weekend and smoke everybody.
Yeah, really. I know he told me, I did one of these with him, and he said that he thinks he was the first guy to hit whoops in fourth gear. That was sort of his thing, you know?
I believe it.
Yeah. Do you have any other weird stories about Bale? Did you ever interact with him, or did you ever?
You know, the only other story I have about him is not a great one, and I was so pissed at the guy. We were at Paris Raceway, and I'm guessing on these years, so don't quote.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm guessing it was around 92 or 93, maybe 94. I don't know. Anyways. He was out. He was practicing on his works bike, and we were doing some final testing on the pre-production bike.
Mm-hmm.
And Dave Arnold was the team manager of the race team at the time. You know what? It was a little bit later. He was actually working at Honda R&D, so he asked Bale to come ride our bike. It was almost our finished bike that was going to go to production.
Yeah,
and he didn't. You could tell he didn't want it. He was kind of you know, pissed off. Yeah. So he gets on our bike, and he stands up, and he rides one lap on it. He doesn't even go. He just kind of cruises around one lap, and he comes in, and he's like, this is shit. You can't produce this bike. There's no way you can put this, you know. He's just going off, and I'm, like, sitting there looking at him. I'm just like, are you kidding me right now? And he walks away, and I go, well, I guess when you just get off, like, the best motorcycle in the world, his works bike, and then you get on our bike, and you ride one lap standing up, you might think that. But I was pissed. I'm like, are you kidding? It was almost like he just, you know, it was like, you know, these stereotype French people, how they act, and that was completely him that day. I'm like, oh, dude.
And this thing you've been working months on, months and months, you know?
And it was good. It wasn't like it was a pile of crap. I mean, I think it won all the shootouts that year, in 93 or 94, whenever it was. I don't remember.
So when you moved into the R&D, Dave Arnold was your boss, and that was pretty cool because I used to sneak into the Yamaha R&D, and I could see what those guys were doing. And they had some cool stuff that never saw the light of day, and then they had some real cool stuff that, you know, was a couple years down the line or whatever. I remember the aluminum frame Yamahas were all painted blue, you know, and so you really had no idea. But you must have saw some cool stuff, huh?
Oh, yeah, and when we would go to Japan, you just see some amazing things that we, you know, never saw the light of day, you know, automatic transmissions and all kinds of crazy stuff. It was fun. I mean, just seeing the technology and the different things and things that are so cool looking, you're like, oh, that's badass. And then you ride it, and it's the worst thing you've ever ridden in your life. It's.
I know they had a twin-cylinder 125 Johnny Ill rode, he told me one time.
Yeah, you know, that was before me, but I definitely heard about it. And, they were talking about it, but that was before me.
Was there one Honda model that you felt really was good, like the one that you worked on maybe the most, or the one that you're like, dude, this is a great bike? And, I mean, is there anyone that sticks out to you?
Well, the 93 CR250 was, I mean, it was amazing. I mean, that was the bike, you know, even Jeremy, that's the one he rode all the way through 96. They just kept the 93 frame. The problem with the 93 frame is it was so soft that they would have to switch it every single race because it would stretch.
Yeah.
But it was just so good. I mean, it wasn't super stable, but man, the thing turned good. The motor was insane. The suspension was good. Everything about it was just good, man. That bike was just a good bike.
Yeah, I had a 90. I had a 90 and 91 CR250s, and I had a 92. And the 90-91 suspension, I didn't like it at all. And 92 was much better for whatever reason. Just the whole package was really good.
Yeah.
I was with you on that. Why is it, maybe you can answer this, maybe you can't, why is it that you see a Honda will go with KYB 1 year, Showa the next year, they'll switch it around the models, Kawasaki does the same thing, Kawasaki's 250F has Showa, the 450 is KYB, what's up with that?
Well, there's probably a lot more to it than I actually know. I do know that every year we test Showa and KYB and kind of have like a little shootout between the two of them. At Suzuki we did that. At Honda we didn't do it so much. They kind of made the decisions in-house, but I think that it's just really political. I know that, you know, the Japanese companies are very loyal and they are try to be very fair, and I think that just has a lot to do with it. I think it's more political than not. At Suzuki, the last couple of years, we actually had shootouts between KYB and Showa, and we ended up going with Showa for the last few years. But I think a lot of it's really political. Same with the tires.
Now, when you're tires are another thing. Man, Bridgestone Doug will go off for probably as long as you want to stand there about magazine testing and tires. But anyways, when you're riding the bikes, you know, you're obviously a top pro rider. The stuff is soft for you, right? I mean, are you trying to think of the average guy, or is your mandate make the bike the best you can for Rich Taylor?
Well, I mean, you know, that's such a frustrating question because we'll go out and we'll make the bikes for us, and we'll make them so they work really, really good for us.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, 1 year I raced Hangtown National on bone stock Honda suspension that was going to come out the following year. I mean, the stuff was good. It wasn't too soft. It was plush. It worked really well.
Uh-huh.
The problem is, and any, you know, anybody who works at any of the OEMs will tell you, we'll come up with settings, and then they'll go back to Japan, and, you know, whether it's the suspension company or the OEM Japan company, something always ends up getting changed for money reasons or whatever. You know, a lot of times the Showa or KYB will put the suspension on a dyno, then they'll put inexpensive parts in the fork or shock and put it back on the dyno, and if it looks the same on the dyno, then that's what they send us.
Right.
But, you know, as we all know, something on the dyno isn't the same as when you're actually out riding.
Yeah,
it. So
track feel.
It's weird. I mean, I wish I had a true answer for you. We build the stuff for us. We make it stiff. We make it plush. But what comes is what comes. It's really, really, that's the most frustrating part of doing testing, and I've done it for a long time.
Pardon my ignorance here, but would you want a bike set up for a 170-pound top pro? You wouldn't want that, right? Because you're in the upper 5% of the world of riding a motorcycle, you know?
Again, though, you know, when you set a bike up for a 170-pound pro who's hauling butt across the tops of whoops and braking bumps and acceleration bumps, and then you take a 190-pound novice guy, that 190-pound guy is actually going to need his suspension way stiffer than the pro.
Right.
So it's a little bit deceiving. I mean, you can go one of two ways. You can make it real foo-foo and soft and plush, so the minute you get on it, you know, and you hit the first little bump, it feels good. But the minute you jump into a hole or, you know, land, it's just going to bottom out, which is usually what test riders do and what OEMs do. They want it to be set up a little bit softer so it's plusher and people think it's good. Well, throughout the years, we learned that, you know, that's not the case, because the minute a magazine guy gets on it, he's going to go into the first hole and say it bottoms out and then just rip it in the magazine. So we started trying to set them up stiff and make it so they just work good. And, you know, if it doesn't work for you, then you know what? You need to click the clickers in. Or if you're light, you need to click the clickers out. And hopefully there's a wide enough range that it'll work for you.
Well, I mean, for many years, man, it just seemed like you would take the stock springs and throw them in the garbage before you even rode the bike. Every bike was... And, I mean, this is talking a svelte Steve Mathis now, not the current version. You know, like, it just seemed like you would always just put the... First thing that goes is the springs if you're anywhere around 170 pounds 80 pounds, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and you know, for a long time that's the way it was. Nowadays
I think it's better,
know,
huh? Yeah,
a lot of times motocross action will immediately say that the springs are too soft, but you know what, everybody's riding style is different, and for a lot of guys it is. You know, if you weigh 180 pounds and you're not that fast, you need stiff springs, believe it or not, because you're hitting every hole with all your weight. You're not gliding across anything.
Yeah.
So, you know, to each their own, you know. It's kind of a sore subject with me, because for so many years I took pride in kind of the settings that came out, and and it's you know, you get ripped. You know, you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. You make the stuff stiff, everybody's going to say it's way too harsh. If you make it soft, then it's way too soft, you know. So you kind of got to trust in what comes. You know, what comes is pretty darn good. It's not going to work for everybody, but it's going to work for a lot of people, you know.
Right, right. We'll get back to that magazine stuff in a little bit. When you were at Honda, you know, we all know the 97 CR250 was the friggin' space age machine coming out, first year of aluminum frame, and the thing just looked bitching, and it turned out to be one of the worst bikes that's in recent memory for Hondas, no doubt about it. When did you start riding that aluminum frame? How soon ahead? A couple years?
Yeah, about two years. We started riding it in like 95. We were going over to Japan riding the thing, and it was actually really good.
Yeah.
It worked really well. It was, you know, it worked way better than the 96 at the time. And it's kind of funny, because they sent Lampson and McGrath over to race the Japan Supercross.
Mm-hmm.
And they rode the thing at the test track, like, I don't know, a couple days before the race, and they both wanted to race it. They're like, this is the best thing ever. Don't touch it.
Yeah.
Well, right after they did that, the frames started breaking right after they rode it. They did like a little durability on it, and the frame started cracking. So they started stiffening the frame up, and then it would crack some more, and they'd stiffen it up, and they just kept stiffening the frame up until the bike was so stiff you could hardly ride it. We had a nickname for it. We called it the lead pipe. It was just, it was a monster, you know? Yeah. And by the time it was getting close to coming out for production, our lap times on the 96 stock bike was almost 6 seconds a lap faster at the test track in Tochigi in Japan.
Really?
And I'm
six seconds
guys,
a lap.
This is unacceptable, man. You can't, there's no way. And
you were really telling them, you were saying, hey, dude, you can't let this bike out.
Yeah, you know, and actually I was really bitter about it because I had a lot going on, and I was just, I'd come in and I'd just be like, this thing, you know, sucks. Yeah. I wasn't being political at all. I was just being actually a real jerk about it because I was just kind of fed up with it. I was, you know, I had a bunch of stuff going on in my personal life, and I'm just like, you know what, this bike sucks. And I would say it straight to the straight to the Japanese engineers. And finally, Dave Arnold was the head of Honda R&D at the time, and he came up to me and he's like, I understand this thing sucks, it's not working, but just do me a favor, say something positive about the bike before you just rip into it. So I'd come off the track and I'd be like, man, this thing looks so good, and then I would turn around and just go, but it's the worst bike I've ever ridden.
Yeah,
go off saying what a pile it was. But it was too, you know, they were too far into it, they'd already advertised it, you know, the magazines had already gotten wind of it, and they just had to put it out, you know. So
they were like, the Japanese are like, ah, Taylor's son, not so good testing. Not so happy.
That bike was not. It's funny because I have a brand new one sitting here. Suzuki had one that they never used, and I got it, so it's sitting in my garage, kind of a little collector's item.
Oh yeah, I'd like to buy that off you, actually. That'd be cool to have, no doubt about it. So that bike wasn't one that you were really proud of.
Not at all. No, yeah. Not at all. You know, I mean, and it was just a shame because it was so, it was innovative. It was,
right.
You know,
yeah.
You go back in history and you look at bikes that you really anticipate, and that was like one, you know, that and the Yamaha 4-stroke was like two of the biggest, you know, things that you wanted to ride. They're like, you know, the greatest things going at the time.
Right.
And then to have it just be a bomb was a bummer.
Yeah.
Sure.
Now, you. When did the Honda gig end for you?
It actually ended in 97.
Coincidence? Was it a coincidence or no?
What's that?
Was it a coincidence?
It was, yeah, you know, it was me being, thinking I was something I wasn't. It was kind of something I'm really kind of a little bit bummed out about. I had a great deal at Honda. They treated me great, and I just got too big for my britches, you know, and the year before in 96, I had done really good on the nationals, and in 97, I was struggling on that bike, and you know, Dave Arnold was saying he was going to get me some good, better parts for it, and which I didn't need, you know, and I went to Gainesville and did really cruddy, and then went to a supercross in Minneapolis, and I'm like, you know what, I'm just going to quit. DeCoster, you know, I knew I had a deal with Suzuki
for 90. Concert,
yeah, to do some testing, and so I switched. It was a big mistake. I was actually at Minneapolis and I won the semi, and when I was on the podium and a bunch of the Japanese engineers were there, I'm like on the podium thinking I'm Ricky Carmichael or something, and I'm like, yeah, I'd just like to thank Honda. I'm going to be on a Suzuki next week.
Jeez, dude.
Really good, so.
Wow, you were a dick, RT.
Kinda, yeah. Here I am getting, you know, 11th place, and I think I'm Ricky Carmichael.
Well, you did hole shot Washougal. You did have that Boswell carburetor, and you hole shot it. But so you started at Suzuki, and this was 97, 98. Their bikes, they were kind of, they needed some work back then, didn't they?
Oh, man, the bike was so slow
right.
in 97. It was so slow. No matter what you did to it, even, you know, I even would, you know, the minute I went to Suzuki, I was riding McGrath's bike and doing a bunch of testing for DeCoster, and the bike, Jeremy's bike that year was so slow. It was ridiculous that he even won one race.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe it. It just, no matter what they did, I mean, he had Mitch Payton, who's, you know, one of the best motor guys in the world.
Yeah.
and his bikes were still slow, you know? They're just, that bike was...
Yeah, I mean, LaRocco basically quit. He was just over it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, there's nothing you could do, man, nothing.
Wow.
But 98, you know, 98, they started getting fast. In 99, mm-hmm. the RM250 was really fast.
Yeah.
It was a rocket, man. Those were great bikes.
And you're going to take credit for that, of course.
Oh, absolutely.
You were there testing them. What did you think of the four-stroke for the Yamaha when you first rode it, when you got one? And I mean, everybody knows the OEMs all buy each other's bikes. So what did you think about that?
You know, I loved it. I was like, this is it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It was funny because I did the magazine test, the magazine intro, and Joel Albrecht was one of their test riders. And I remember getting off the bike, and he's like, how do you like it? How do you like it? And I was like, you know, it's all right.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking to myself, this thing is rad, you know? I mean, it's got all this power. It handles pretty good, even though when you think about it now, it wasn't that great of a bike.
No,
But it kind of was, you know? It mm-hmm. was, but it wasn't, you know?
And, right.
I'm just like, oh, we all have to do this now, you know?
So why did it take Suzuki so long compared to everybody else?
Partly because it's Suzuki. You know, if you know the Japanese company, Suzuki's by far the smallest one.
Yeah.
So, you know, it just took them a lot longer to mm-hmm. develop it and come out with it and do it, you know?
What do you think of, I don't know how much you read the message boards, I don't think you read them at all, actually, but what do you think of the people, there's a big uprising, why did we ever go to four strokes, they're ruining the sport, they're too expensive to rebuild, you know, a good old two-stroke was where it was at, because people are just pining for the old days. My opinion on that is, you know, everybody's wallet spoke for themselves, because those things flew off the dealership floors, four strokes.
Yeah.
What's your take on the two-stroke versus four-stroke?
Well, you know, it's funny because when the four-strokes were first coming, it was like, yeah, totally. The four-strokes, you know, are awesome. And now that the two-strokes are gone, everybody kind of misses them. So, you know, I think if all the two-strokes were back and the four-strokes were gone, it'd be the same way. You know, I don't think there's any, you know, that... I'm pretty sure that the reason we all went to four strokes in the first place is because of emissions and, you know, the whole rumors about two strokes being outlawed and all that. I think that's what the OEMs were thinking to begin with. I could be wrong. You know, it could just be progression, you know.
They sure allow everybody to be a much better rider because you can be lazy, you know.
That's for sure. And, you know, that's actually a really good point. You go to Glen Helen on a Thursday and there's, you know, 100 kids that are going so freaking fast, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And you know, the bikes are a big part of that.
Yeah, for sure. So you start testing for Suzuki, you're now retired from racing. What happened to the RMZ450 when it first came out? What was the deal? They just kept breaking and they were recalled, and was that all you,
well,
Rich? I heard that was all you.
No, of course it was me.
Yeah.
Of course it was me. That was all my fault.
that was a big mess,
you know,
for sure.
When it first came out, you know, again, what you got to understand is Suzuki, compared to the other companies, is way smaller. And,
uh-huh.
and the durability that they do is a lot less. I mean, when the first RMZ450 came out, it was actually a really good bike. It had some little problems. I don't know that it was breaking that much. You know, one of the problems it did have was the chain adjuster, the
cam chain adjuster,
the timing chain adjuster was manual. It wasn't automatic. It was manual. So every couple rides you had to adjust the thing.
Uh-huh.
You know, I think this was 06, and people just didn't do it. You know,
right?
05, 06, they. When did it come out? 05?
I think 05, yeah.
So I think that was a big part of it. You know, I know I didn't. I never did. I never adjusted it, and I never had one blow up, but people who rode them a lot blew them up all the time because they didn't adjust that thing.
I thought they had a kickstart gear problem, and I thought they had...
Well, now you're talking 08, when the first fuel-injected one just, you know...
Oh, I'm getting it mixed up? Okay.
Yeah. Last year, that was just kind of a wacky thing that happened. What they did is... The cases were just a little bit too thin in a certain spot,
mm-hmm.
and the Kickstarter gear would move just enough to hit the case and crack it.
Jeez. So I mean, that really hurt them.
The bummer is, is that bike is a bitchin' bike. Mm-hmm. I mean, I stand behind it. The thing is good.
Yeah.
They just it just got killed by the magazines because they all broke them the first day they rode them. So of course they're going to say they're horrible. You know, I don't blame them, but kind of got a bad rap because once they fix the cases, the bike's a good bike, really good bike.
No, I got buddies who have them, and they swear by them. They love them. Just the damage was done for Suzuki, and now you see the shootouts are coming out now, and Suzuki's not even in them, 2010 bikes. So
Yeah.
It's kind of a bad deal.
There's some issues. You know, there's a lot of stuff that kind of went down and happened down at Suzuki, and my contract ended in September, so I don't really even know what's going on down there now.
But, right. It's just punishing to them, though. It just halts all your sort of market share, you know? I don't know.
It's horrible. And the shame is the 2010 RMs, and I don't mean to be a salesman, but the 250 is insane. It's fuel injected, the thing's bitching. And the 450 is too. The motor's a little bit better than the 09. It's faster, it's got a broader power band, it's easier to ride. The thing rips, you know. Yeah. It's a shame. It's a real shame.
Do you have a favorite Suzuki of all those years testing and working on the next year's models?
Well, the 99 RM250 was just, I love that bike.
Yeah.
That thing was so fast. It had a real broad power band. It had, it revved to the moon. You could just, the thing, I love that bike.
Yeah.
The 08, 09, 010 450s that are fuel injected, I mean, that's just the next level. The fuel injection is awesome.
How long have you been testing that for before it came out?
We tested it for about a year.
Yeah, we had it at Yamaha like 05, my last year there.
Did you?
Yeah, there was a bike that came over from Japan with it.
Yeah.
So,
Yamaha compared to Suzuki right there.
Yeah, exactly. Let's talk a little bit, man. I could just go on forever with questions about the Honda days and the Suzuki days, but let's go on to magazines a little bit. Now, you've been involved in the process of making a motorcycle from, the very beginning, being, a major influence on it. What do you think of when you read a magazine test of a bike? I mean, do they get it right? Do they get it wrong? Do they all get it right? What's your thoughts?
No, they definitely get a lot of it right.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the time. it just depends. It seems like, the different magazines always kind of say the same thing about the bikes.
Mm-hmm.
There's definitely times that I'll know something's not good with a bike that I've ridden or that I've tested, and somebody will point it out, and I'll be like, wow, that's pretty...
Really?
Even though they said it's bad, that's pretty cool that they even noticed it.
Can you give an example? Or do you want to give an example? That's kind of cool.
We had a problem shifting on 1 year of the RM250. I don't even want to say what year it was, but it was pretty bad. But it wasn't... It was kind of minor.
Mm-hmm. But if you spent hours on the bike, you're like, you notice.
And we tried to fix it and did so many things, and none of the magazines even said anything about it except one of them. I don't even want to say which one, but they got it, And another example is we had on one of the RM250s, actually Dirt Bike Magazine caught this spot of the carburetor, like quarter throttle. Like when you were riding in the pits, you'd be like barely quarter throttle, and the thing would be blubber, and it wouldn't run right.
Uh-huh.
When you were on the track, you could never feel it.
Right, but you were never there,
Unless you kind of slowed down and kind of cruised out of a corner, and then you'd feel it. And Dirt Bike actually caught it, and it was a spot that we worked and worked and worked on and couldn't get it right. Fix it.
So Dirt Bike had the slowest testers.
I don't know about that.
Yeah, no, I know. I'm just kidding. I'm kidding.
But there's sometimes, but then there's a lot of times when they just say stuff, and you're like, "Are you kidding? That is so wrong.
Really?
So not right."
Yeah. Does it get you mad? Like, I mean, not now, maybe, but when you were into it, when you were.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, you'd get pissed, huh?
Motocross Action, when I was at Honda 1 year, said they need to fire all their test riders. And, all the other magazines rated the Honda number one that year.
Yeah.
And MXA rated the Yamaha or something number one.
Right.
And I was like, damn. I'm like, you have no idea what we do out here and what actually happens when it goes back to Japan and everything else.
Well,
and to say something like that's just... You know, I when I was younger, I just used to take it so personal,
right.
I shouldn't have. You know, now I just let it, you know, water off my back. I could, you know, I could care less. Say what you want.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm out there doing the best I can, and it is what it is.
Yeah, and Yamaha would know all that kind of stuff from Ed Scheidler told them was what they believed. So, I mean,
Scheidler was awesome with the magazines.
He
man.
Was.
That guy had
I know
relationships. He was such a good dude, man.
How much
he knew how to work it.
How much of that is reflected in the test? The guy you send out in the box, man.
Oh, absolutely a ton.
Yeah,
I mean it's 100%. You know, Suzuki's had a problem with that since day one because they never had one guy in there who had that great relationship with the magazines. Where mm-hmm. Scheidler was there for 30 years
yeah,
or
yeah,
25
exactly.
years.
Yeah.
Who knows? He was there with the magazines. He was, you know, one of Jody's great friends. You know, he was just a likable, super
yeah.
cool guy, and you'd listen to him. He was super knowledgeable, and it was hard to argue with him. You know, he knew
right.
what he was doing.
Right.
You know, same with Eric Krippa at Honda. You know, Krippa was around forever.
Is Krippa still
Everyone
doing
loved
it?
Loved Krippa.
Is he still doing it?
He just retired earlier
oh,
this
did
year.
He?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Honda
yeah.
offered a severance package to him, and he took it.
Yeah. 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 He's been there forever too. Same deal.
Yeah.
So that
it's that relationship that they get with the magazine that just it makes a huge difference.
Yeah, I was
your bike's already going to do better just because you have this relationship.
I know when I was at KTM, a couple of magazine guys told me, "What's up with Moen?" And I'm like, "What do you mean?" They're like, "I tell him the shock's a little stiff," and he goes, "Go faster or whatever," you know. Like,
you got to know Moen though.
Oh,
know?
I know.
It's his super dry personality, and he kind of
oh,
you know,
I know.
That's Moen's. I dig Moen. He's great, but he's definitely a guy. You know,
he's not going to pamper these dudes.
Guy,
yeah,
you're going to be scared shitless of the guy for sure.
I know.
He's funny, but you know, it's that relationship. I think every OEM should have one guy that does it every year and makes these relationships and you know, I hate to say it, but you really got to kiss the magazine's ass. It's
yeah.
so political, you know, it is so political.
Yeah. So right now you do some testing work for Transworld. How much, when you're testing a bike, does your mind go back to like, what was this guy thinking when he designed, like, you know what I mean? Like you probably look at it a lot differently than say a average magazine tester guy.
Well, you know, I do. Like you know, I the Honda last year, the 09 Honda 450, you know, I jumped on that bike and I rode it, and I immediately just, you know, the balance was so off, and I was thinking, you know, immediately you think about the test riders.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Better because
yeah.
a lot of it's not their fault,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
It's more just, man, what was Honda thinking? Why? How would you sell a bike where the balance of the suspension is so far off? You know, the thing was like a giant stink bug
yeah.
right out of the box.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, no test rider, I don't
would
care
approve
who you
that.
Are.
Yeah, yeah.
you know, the very first thing you're going to get right usually is the balance of the bike, at least, you know. So
yeah.
That was definitely one.
Yeah, that bike seemed to be, I mean, it won a couple of shootouts. And then it got last in a couple of shootouts. It was
again,
a very.
I don't want to name names or anything, but there's so much political stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and not so much political, but just relationships, you know?
Where, yeah.
I don't know. I think a couple magazines kind of jumped to the gun on that where they should have just.
Like
ridden it a little more.
Like Dirt Rider did with the Cannondale. It was a bike of the year. Right?
Yeah,
did you ever ride one of those? Did you ever
that
ride?
That was a funny story. I actually went to that intro that year, and I broke six sets of wheels. I broke
six wheels.
We were at Elsinore that uh-huh. day. And I was so bummed because the bike, you know, it was aluminum frame. It had fuel injection. There were so many cool things about it.
Yeah.
And I wanted it to be good so bad. And, man, I rode a lap and a half and broke a wheel. Came in, they changed it. I rode a couple more laps, broke another wheel.
Yeah.
It just kept breaking wheels. And
yeah.
finally, they're like, you know what? Let's not have you ride these anymore. And I wasn't doing anything wrong. I was just riding it Elsinore.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. I mean, flat, hard-packed track. You were probably jumping pretty good, you know? But
yeah, yeah. And you know what? And it was another thing. It wasn't even Cannondale's fault, really. They were buying, I think they were Excel rims, but it was some weird hub they had
yeah.
that, you know, it wasn't even really their fault.
Yeah, that kind of stuff. Yeah, you're right. Was there one innovation that you tested that worked really good that never saw the light of day for whatever reason? Was there something for whatever reason that you were like, hey, this thing works so good, and then it just got buried for whatever cost reasons, political reasons, anything? Even back in the day at Honda or anything?
Not really.
No.
You know, just some ignition stuff that they couldn't do, different kinds of ignitions that just made the bikes rip. This was mainly back on two-stroke days.
Yeah.
Stuff that was just really fast that they couldn't produce because of durability issues.
Mm-hmm. Now, okay, go ahead.
Go ahead. No, that's it.
My dad's got a theory. I don't know. I haven't spoken to him for years about this, but this was his theory. Conventional forks work just as good as any upside downs you'll ever find. And, you know, it was all a marketing gimmick. And, you know, upside down forks are nothing special. And there's nothing better than 89 KYB forks that came on the Cowies. What are your thoughts on that?
No, not so much. No, you know, when
so my dad was full of shit. My dad's full of shit.
The harder you ride
yeah.
and the way tracks are today, there's no way. It's just. It's the way that, you know, the clamps and the flex points of the forks, there's there's really no way, you know. A lot of people think, oh, well, if your forks flex, they're going to be plusher and they're going to work better. I kind of completely disagree. You know, I think actually really stiff forks are going to work better because they won't be as harsh because every time you hit a bump and there's no flex, the fork is going to be working. When there's a little bit of flex, you're going to feel it in your arms. For every flex, there's going to be a reaction.
Mm-hmm.
So I was kind of the opposite. You know, I used to do a lot of testing with Ross Maeda at Enzo, and he actually had these triple clamps that were like a one-piece triple clamp.
Oh, yeah.
So that the tops of the forks couldn't flex at all.
Mm-hmm.
They were just rigid and solid as could be. They worked a little bit, but now, you know, the big billet clamps are actually better than the ones we were using back then. But
right. I know Ferry had an old 89 Cowie at his house for whatever reason, and he was going to blitz his whoops, and he wanted me to call Ross and ask him if the bike could do it. And I'm like, of course it can do it. He's like, let's videotape it and all this. And I call Ross, and I swear, Rich, Ross is like, no, do not do that. Do not do that. He will break those forks. Dude, Steve, do not let him do. Like, it was kind of funny. Like, he was getting serious about it. Like, he's like, they can't do that. They can't go fourth gear across the top of whoops.
Yeah, no. I mean, the way tracks are today, there's mm-hmm. just we're going in the right direction. If anything, I could see the forks getting bigger and beefier before they ever get upside down again.
But have you noticed Stewart went back down to 48s, and a lot of teams have been going back down on shock shaft size in the last couple years.
Yeah, and, you know, I think a lot of that is because now the chassis are getting so stiff as well. And they're trying to compensate a little bit for it. But I don't know that you're going to – my guess is that you're going to see them go back up.
Yeah.
I think they're going to get stiffer.
I'm just wondering if there's a tipping point. We've reached it with 50-millimeter forks and 18-millimeter shock shafts. You know what I mean? The bikes just aren't responding. I don't know. You know more than I do, certainly.
Yeah, so. I don't know. From everything I've tested,
mm-hmm.
the bigger stuff always seems to kind of – just work better, you know.
Yeah. Well, your fork flex theory is interesting because there is a magazine, and it goes by the initials of MXA, that always seem to complain about being stiff and harsh. You know, they almost a lot of the bikes that they don't like are harsh and stiff, and it just seems to be something that you always read for a bike that they don't like. You know.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
And you also read all the time. You know, you need to put a gear on the rear sprocket. Go one tooth up on the rear, you know, almost constantly, you know, so it's funny how that works.
I mean, everybody's kind of got their own theory. I don't, you know,
right.
To each their own kind of when it comes to that, for sure. So
who was the best, besides yourself, who was the best test rider that you've ever worked with or seen?
Oh, wow. Man.
You know, I always thought I always heard Somo was really good, but I have no idea. You know, honestly, I don't know.
Somo.
You're laughing.
That could be
so
a whole story in itself, man. Yeah. Somo was all right. He was all right.
But is there somebody that just really could nail it well? I mean, that you felt in tune with or that maybe picked out things that you didn't feel?
You know, this is going to sound crazy to everyone who knows him, but Jim Chamberlain, Jungle Jim? Jungle Jim, you remember Jim?
Yeah, I know Jungle, yeah.
Yeah, Jungle is pretty good test rider. He can feel stuff. he is so finicky. Mm-hmm. He can feel a lot of stuff. I remember one time he used to do stuff with us at Honda, and I remember one time getting on a bike and he came in and he's like, the foot pegs are back. How come the foot pegs are so far back? I didn't even notice it.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, they'd move them back like 10 millimeters, and you know, I didn't even catch it. He knew right off the bat.
Yeah.
He's pretty good, man, with motors and with shocks, and you know, he knows how to build motors and build shocks as well, shocks and forks. So he's pretty good. He's, you know, it's probably a big surprise, but he's pretty awesome at it.
When you walk around the pits today or go to a Supercross or National today, do you watch the bike's performance? Can you tell from the stands whose bike is working and who's not?
Sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Same
you
with
know,
me.
The,
I think same as me.
Sometimes,
you know?
For
yeah.
sure.
I can notice guys' bikes, too, and I'm like, is it just me? Am I crazy? So then usually I'll call Ross, and I'll be like, hey, Ross, am I nuts? Because I saw this guy's bike. It didn't look good. And he'd be like, yeah, you're right. So I'd be like, okay. Other times he'd say, like, no, I never noticed. But, you know.
Yeah, you can definitely, you know, through the whoops and just balance of the bike, you can tell if something's soft.
Yeah.
Definitely. I'm always looking at it, and I'm always ready to go tell somebody, and then I'm like, ah, you know what? It's not my job.
Yeah, I mean, working
funny
with...
you said that, because yeah. I was just watching. They've got some video up of, I think Transworld or RacerX has some video of Reed and Villopoto.
Mm-hmm.
Their intro, their little intro on the Cowies, and they come out of a turn and they're blitzing the whoops, and Reed blazes across them, and then Villopoto's in the same line, but his bike is just flopping back and forth, and
yeah.
I'm just like, either he's got a really bad setting, or else Reed is just the man that we know he is, you know?
Right, right, yeah.
Pretty
well,
funny.
I mean, you working with, in recent years, working with Suzuki, I mean, so, you know, the opportunity was there at the races to go talk to Roger or Ian, and say, hey, what do you, you know, try this or whatever, you know? I don't know. Did you ever do that? Did you ever?
Yeah, I did. I did a couple times with you know, a couple settings that I knew were good. Usually motor settings, like, mm-hmm. you know, I'd get there and tell them to try it in practice. As far as suspension goes, I never said anything. I mean, that's a, you know, a lot of times the rider, when they get to the race, that's the last thing they want to think about. If they're having trouble, then they'll start complaining
yeah.
about it. But if they feel even decent, you know, the last thing they're going to do is tell them to switch it up.
Yeah, yeah. And DeCoster never came to you and was like, Rich, I can't figure out Robbie Renard. He is so fast one weekend and so slow the next.
No, but, you know, I got a funny story because I do some stunt work, and I was in Chicago.
Yeah, you do it all. Goggles. Testing, racing, stunt work.
Got to make the money, man. I was in Chicago, and the guys I was working for there are all motocross dudes. They're older guys
mm-hmm.
that have raced forever, and you know, Roger DeCoster, and is just, you know, their hero like
right.
everybody else. And we're sitting there in the hotel lobby, and DeCoster calls me. This is when the new 450 came out,
uh-huh.
and we had trouble with it in the beginning because it would pop and sputter real bad.
Oh, dude. Yeah, Ricky's bike was gnarly.
Yeah, really bad. And
yeah.
so he called me, and here I am in this hotel lobby with all these stunt guys, and I held my phone up, and it's Roger DeCoster. They're like, no way. I talked to him for like an hour about it and just get, you know,
yeah.
told him kind of what I knew about you know, the R&D stuff and compared to the race team stuff. So it was kind of funny.
Do you think that the EFI, and again, dude, I can go on forever. We should probably start wrapping this up. But do you think the EFI, does it give you a little bit neutral performance compared to a carburetor? A little bit, let's say, flatter performance than a carburetor? Do you find that at all?
No, man. The EFI is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
It's insane. I mean, everybody's going to have it here shortly, and everybody should. It just makes it so much easier. The only thing it's going to do is, you know, the aftermarket companies building motors and stuff are going to be, you know, they're going to be hurting a little bit just because you can plug the thing into a computer and make it run any way you want it to.
Yeah, true that. That thing did pop a lot. You're right about that. God, Ricky would have that thing pegged.
Yeah, just buttering and popping.
Did you help? Did you try to help? Were you one of the guys that tried to help RC get away from his stupid setting he ran at Honda all those years? You know, because, man,
no,
he didn't go that way on a Suzuki.
The greatest guy ever to change
I know, but, hey, he didn't go that way on a Suzuki, though. He stopped that way, you know?
Yeah, he ended up pulling his bars up and riding it a little more normal. But, man, his setting is still weird.
Is it?
Still,
yeah.
You know, his bikes are tiny. Just everything about him, you sit on it and you're like, wow.
Yeah.
This thing is just miniature.
Well,
and, yeah.
Let's. What was the weirdest bike, factory guy's bike, you've ever ridden? Setting-wise or just whatever.
Well, you know, this isn't a works bike or anything, but I rode, we had an RM250 one time they sent over in an aluminum frame.
Oh, yeah?
And it was probably the worst motorcycle I've ever ridden in my life. It was,
what year would this have been?
This would have been in like 2000, maybe 2002,
mm-hmm.
right around then.
Yeah.
They built this big, giant aluminum frame,
mm-hmm.
sent it over. It was like top secret. We went to Carlsbad, actually.
What? Really?
Yeah, they wanted to test it at Carlsbad, and we showed up, and it was so bad. It was just absolutely horrible. Just horrible.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like riding a big, giant box, man.
They never really put much thought into it. They just built an aluminum frame and dropped it in the existing chassis dimensions, you know? Like, that's
no, probably, you know, we were scheduled to test it for like 3 days, and we rode it that one day, and,
mm-hmm.
and they immediately sent it back to Japan. It was terrible.
Wow.
So.
I don't know if I've ever heard that before. Well, thanks for doing this, man. I could keep going on and on. We need to maybe do another time.
To talk about magazines one day for sure.
Yeah, yeah. No, I'd like to get your take on more magazine stuff. But you know, we're an hour and 13 minutes in, and it's late at night on a near Christmas. So, thanks for doing the Racer X podcast show, man. I appreciate it.
No, it's a great show. Hopefully, more people will start listening, you know, not just to me, but everybody, man. These shows, you do a good job. Hate to stroke you a little bit.
Yeah, no, don't tell me that. Bill Goggle's good, too, though, I'll tell you what. Yeah, no, interesting stuff. I think people are really going to kick out of this one. I found it interesting, and you're a good guy, too. You've done it all in the stunt work, too. We could get into the stunt work, too, because Holly told me, well, I don't know, I was BSing with Holly one time, and his stories are awesome from stunt work, you know, like,
yeah, of like, course, any story you get from Holly,
well, that's true,
can't tell on this show because kids listen, so.
No, and actually Holly could probably tell you about going to the store to buy milk, and it would be awesome, you know what
it
I mean
would be, oh, it'd be one of the best stories you ever heard.
Yeah,
for sure.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yep.
No, for sure. All right, RT, well, thank you for doing the show, and we will do a part two, and thanks again, man. I'll talk to you soon.
All right, Steve, we'll talk to you.
All right, see you.
All right.